Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Don A. For getting me here, and Steve and Ann for being such terrific hosts. I guess this gives a whole new meaning in my life to marathon meeting. I mean, I think I left to come to this meeting 16, 17 hours ago, and I've eaten several meals. I've had desserts. I've been entertained. I'm just thankful the Clydesdales didn't show up, you know, like and the monkey hack broke down. But the deal is for those of you who are in these seats, this is a long, 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 long prelude. I remember in high school having to sit through Macbeth, and I thought that was long, you know. And Torrance sounds like such a snappy name, you know. You would just figure they'd be humming along, you know. So now we'd like to do our rendition of the Prohibition years, you know. and then skipping right into World War II, you know. And in case some of you were here during the Eisenhower years, we wouldn't want to miss that dry spell. So, you know. Whew. I just hope there's no newcomers here. I mean, Jesus Christ. They'd be like, I know, honey, it sounds ridiculous, but the meeting was 8 hours. You know? You know? If I go to 5 a week, it's like a job. You know? You say, oi, yay, yay, yay. You know, holy. I mean, the entertainment was good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I enjoyed it for the first 6-7 hours. And then, you know, when your fruit of the loom start to wink back at you, you're sitting a long time, you know. And I'm getting at that age where I start getting concerned about things I never was concerned about before, you know. I mean, a voice in the back of my head, even right now, was saying to me, you know, you should have thought of that before you left the house, you know. So here we are, and at the South Bay Torrance Roundup, you know. And I don't think it's a stampede, it's a roundup, you know, like, it's a... This is like, whoa, you know. I mean, I began to get Al-Anon flashbacks, you know. I was like, I was beginning to resent me against alcoholics. I thought, well, what the hell is this, you know? But I'm really glad to be here, you know. And I'm glad my birthday was yesterday. I think I sat through another one, you know, like, you know. Lois and Bill think it's too long, too. But I arrived in AA 32 years ago yesterday, I think it was yesterday. And I walked into a place, and I was back on the East Coast in New York, and I walked into a place, and I was wearing a blue wool suit. It was July 5th. Somehow, that was before I knew you were intuitive, they knew I was a newcomer, you know? I looked like I had been in a gang war, and my gang didn't show up, you know, like... The night before, I had fallen off a pier down on the Jersey Shore and got wedged between two pilings, and fortunately didn't wash out to sea. And I had a really bad case of the crabs. I mean, there were sand crabs biting me all over the leg. And friends had been looking for me, and in the morning they found me. And they tried to convince me that maybe social drinking was coming to an end, and that I should be doing something about this. So I had received that word before from many people. I was living with my mom at the time in a senior citizen place. My wife and kids had, for their own sense of security and serenity, moved away. And my mom got a notice saying that one of us had to move out, and since she was the senior citizen, you know, I had been there so long I learned to use the walker. You know, like I was getting good on the walker, and I hated to give it up. And so I went to this meeting, and it was only an hour long. In New York, they start at 9 and end at 10 because they used to say, no soul saved after 10. And so the deal was, I went in and I met this guy, and this guy said to me, newcomer. And they gave me a little red tag, and they asked me my name, and I checked my license, and it was Ken. And so they put Ken on this tag. And I went, and one of the guys said, well, if you want to be a winner, you have to sit up front. And I had been a loser for a long time, so winner sounded really attractive, so I moved up front with the crowd. And somehow, as I said, they just seemed to sense that I had not been there before. I don't know whether it was my gas expulsion. I don't know whether it was the blue suit. I just didn't know quite what it was, but they were coming over, you know, with those little happy faces. Say, you're in the right place, you know. And this guy said he was going to be my temporary sponsor. And by the grace of God, he is still my temporary sponsor. I've had the same sponsor from the first night I walked into AA till today. And, you know, and that's very unusual. And I talked to him this week because he had called about my birthday. And he now has glaucoma and he's diabetic. And there's a lot of things going wrong with him. But I'll tell you, you wouldn't notice it or hear it in anything he tells you, because there's everything right with him. And he's right because he did the right things right here from the get-go. And he's been a hell of a sponsor. You know, I'll be honest with you, and I hope you understand the context in which I'm saying this, is that back east in New York, they don't have these things. They don't know what a convention is. He went to one convention when he was 38 years sober 2 years ago, and Clancy was there, and the two of them were chatting, and I thought, here's two guys that are about the same age as far as chronological age. I don't think there's a convention that Clancy's missed. And here's this guy, it's the first one. And the deal is because they just don't have that. In New York, they have the Bill Wilson dinner once a year at the Waldorf Astoria, and that's it. I mean, if you want to check me out on this, next time they put out the conventions and you want to check them out, see if you see things like, you know, the Brooklyn Fall Roundup, you know? You know? The Bronx Summer Festival, you know, the Queens Get Together, you know, like, you know, they just don't have that kind of stuff, you know. So anyway, this guy said he'd be my sponsor, and he was and is a terrific sponsor. And I had to move out of this place, and I was in the process of going to jail. And I had a habit when I was drinking of finding things before people officially lost them. And I moved into this place which had hot and cold running attics in the hallway. And he came over to visit me. Now, the only thing I got when my wife and I separated, because, and this was as it should be, is she gave me a little Hummel, you know, one of those German figurines that, because my mother had given it to us, and they had a very close relationship, and she was just left it with me when she left. And I had these, like, you know, it was a really nice place I was moving into, and I had these nice orange crates. And I had my clothes in some, and my clothes on the floor in the closet, and my sponsor came over. And when people came to visit me, you know, I really didn't know how to do this thing about having company. And he came in and he had brought me a little hot plate. And he said, you can make coffee with this. And here's a little thing you can make coffee with. And he went to sit down. He's a pretty large guy. And he went to sit down and he went to put his hand on that orange crate. I said, whoa, be careful. He said, why? I said, my Hummel is sitting there.
Yeah.
So he said, "This Hummel here." I said, "Yeah." So he picked it up and he threw it. And it shattered all over the wall. And it was on the floor in little tiny, tiny pieces. And he looked at me and said, "Now you don't have to worry about shit." You know? If somebody breaks in, they'll leave something, you know? You know? And the bottom line was, there was a feeling attached to that. I didn't get to the feeling immediately. But there was a feeling attached to that that was total freedom. I now had absolutely nothing to divert my attention other than getting sober. I didn't own a thing. My fifth step had already been printed in the paper. I had no secrets from anybody. I knew a new freedom that was one of the promises that they told me would come much later. I had it much sooner, you know? And it's an amazing thing when you don't own anything, and you don't have anything, and you don't know anything, you know, you're really comfortable. I had a sense of ease that I had never had in a long time, you know? I found myself smiling at a few people, you know, because there was nothing to contaminate my thinking about who I was. It was obvious who I was. Who I was a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous who belonged right where he was. And the deal was is that this guy and I went on with that relationship, and I came into AA. Now, we were very close guys, and I want to tell you that the guy that came into Alcoholics Anonymous could not stay sober. He could not live happy, joyous, and free. He had a mind that was very, very tricky, and there was a portion of that mind that no matter what the scenario was, that mind would say to him, "Let's go get a drink." And so in order to survive, I had to kill that guy. And I killed him by taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to die on purpose because that guy just couldn't stay sober. I was early on in sobriety, 6 weeks, to give you an example of where I was at. This was in maybe August or September of 70. And what happened was, he said to me, "Come on over to my house." And I was going over his house on a real regular basis to dinner because of the fact that he was just trying to keep me connected. And then he'd say, "Let's go to a meeting," and we'd go to a meeting. And the deal was is I was totally getting immersed in his family because my family, for their own sense of wellness, was somewhere else. And one night, we got a call. Now, this is a guy who has done everything for me for about 6 or 8 weeks, taking me to meetings, feeding me. And this was, I lived in a, there was no mafia. You know, J. Edgar Hoover said there was no mafia. But if there were a mafia, it would live right where I was at, you know? You know, it was that kind of a neighborhood where we had no crime, course we were crime, you know? You know, like, there, you know, it wasn't like you had to worry about anybody stealing anything, because if they did, it never happened again, you know? People say to me, "Well, when you were around in New York in the 60s, you must have really been into drugs. Watch my lips." I never took a drug. I never took a legal drug in the sense of a prescription, and I never took an illegal drug. In my neighborhood, that was very taboo. If you sold or used drugs, the first time they'd get your attention by closing a car door on your hand. It was a reminder that, "Hey, yo, we don't do this in this neighborhood." And if you should forget, there are a few forgetters, that if you forgot, the next time you would disappear. We thought you moved to Jersey, you know? What happened to Philly? "You know, I moved over to Jersey, you know what I mean? You know, he's gone, you know?" They had zero tolerance before it ever became popular. Somehow they knew that dead people did not use or sell drugs. You know, they figured that out early on, you know. They used to say, "Hey, he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot." Ah. Oh.
How far is it to the subway? We don't know. No one's ever made it.
Oh. It's that kind of a neighborhood, you know? So the deal was, is I'm now getting into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing the stuff that you do. And about 6 months ago, actually about 7 months ago, I was on a very prolonged silent retreat. And when I came back, that feeling that I had had when I was in early sobriety was yearning to be re-nurtured or brought out again. So I gave away everything I owned, got rid of my place, and got my life down to 6 Xerox boxes. And I moved over to New Mexico. And there were people who thought, you know, he's a little on the... Yeah, you know. But fortunately, when you're sober, and I am sober, you don't have to explain this stuff to anyone. And you don't care who understands or don't understand, because they're not involved. This is my life. I own it. I don't have a mortgage on it. I own it. And the deal was, it was time to go do this. And people said, so even my sister, because there was a guy I knew in the phone company over there, and he got me a great phone number. It was area code 505-333-2266. You know, remedial people could not remember this number, you know? And the deal was, is I, when my sister heard that I was moving, and I had given everything away, and I had this phone number, she was for sure that I was in the federal witness program. Like, you know, what are you getting into? I thought you weren't doing that. And the deal was, is that it was a great move, because when I went over there, and there's some people I've met over from over there who are over here tonight, the deal is that I got to do things that I don't normally get to do. I got to do industrial amounts of nothing. You know? That's really my strong suit, you know? Not knowing and not doing, I'm your guy. You know, like, oh yeah, you know? And I started to go into meetings with the Indians, the Navajo, and these guys are very, very basic guys, you know, very basic guys. And I got a nickname now in Navajo. I'm called Click Clock. Click Clock means white pony man, because I have an explorer that's white. So, you know, and I would say things and they would come up, because it's all about perception. And I would say things like, you can't have reservation if you're going to stay here. And they go, Click Clock, where does he come from? You know, has no reservation. Where does he come from? You know, and then they told me that my people, they call us the Dian. You know, he said, the Belagana, that's who we are. We're the Belagana. And they said, the Belagana taught us how to wink. And I said, taught you how to wink? He said, yeah. I said, how? And they go, And the deal is that we got to go to meetings, and we got to share, and I got to see things that I never saw in my entire life. I saw an eagle come down and catch a trout in the San Juan River. And I got to sit there and watch this and go, wow, this is amazing. And I got to see other things that I just never got to see before. You know, I learned a lot about ducks watching ducks. Did you ever notice that? You two guys together? Good. The deal is ducks. You know, every now and again on the San Juan, you see these ducks. They're just cruising along, and then they bump into each other. And it's kind of like an accident. And they get all festy up, you know. And then they don't do anything. They just kind of get mad for a minute. And then they swim away. And when they're about 10, 15 yards from one another, they shake all over. And the Indians tell you that's them getting rid of their negativity so they don't have to carry it for the rest of the day. You know? And you know, it came to me that we're the only animal in the animal kingdom that's negative. I mean, and we're the only ones confused. You know? You never hear a frog say, I'm not sure who I am. You know? You never see a parrot carrying resentment. Like, you never see a cat that can't get a good night's sleep. You know? We're the only ones that are all screwed up. You know? And you get to watch people. I have a buddy right now, as we're sitting here, he's in Iran, of all places. And Al-Anon AA and NA and Alateen are going big guns now in Iran, in Tehran, the capital. There are now 8 AA meetings, 16 Al-Anon meetings. Tells you how, you know. And a number of NA meetings. And he said to go and realize that in a mosque, women cannot sit with the men. There's a curtain goes down. And here, they got pictures of the Khomeini. You guys all remember him, you know. And Bill Wilson. You know what I mean? And my buddy Sam says, it is so interesting, you know, to see Bill Wilson with the Khomeini, you know. And yesterday he drove to Om, which is a little south of the capital, Tehran. And it's where the mullahs get trained. And they were having a Bill Wilson and Bob Smith festival, you know, where the mullahs get trained. So, you know, this thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous is just unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Anyway, I had this guy that was sitting around with my sponsor one night. The phone rings, and my sponsor gets on the phone. And when he gets off the phone, we didn't say, like, you know, we got to go save people. He says, we got to go put the hit on this guy. So I said, okay. So this was like, I was going to get a chance to do something now with my sponsor. For the first 6 weeks, he was doing everything for me. So we get in the car, and we drive over there. And it's a typical, you know, scenario. It's a brownstone in Brooklyn, and we can't find a parking space. So he looks at me, as sponsors are, you know, want to do, and he says, could you possibly go get him and bring him out? Now, in my neighborhood, when you say yes to something like that, that's a commitment, you know? So I said, get him and bring him out. He said, yeah, I'll drive around the block and I'll get him. Don't screw up early in sobriety because they'll never let you forget it, you know. So as he tells it, he comes back. And when he pulls up, I got the guy on the ground and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid. Ba-ba-bing, ba-ba-bing, ba-ba-bing. What had happened was the guy decided he didn't want to come to AA. And he was still operating under the delusion that he had a choice. So I gave him a couple of taps after I snagged him through the door because I was carrying the message, you know? If you want what we got, you better, you know. And so my sponsor whistled to me like I was a Doberman. And I came and I get back in the car and we're driving down the street and there's a few blocks of what I would call silence. That means no talking. And then he says, Ken, I want to tell you two things that are very important. First, don't ever consider that a 12-step call. That's number one. And number two is, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor yet. You know, like, you know, let's see how it goes, you know. Let's get a little bit more how we go here. And that's the guy that I had to get rid of. And I got rid of him by taking the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And how I got rid of him was, you know, Dr. Silkworth, who is buried in Long Branch, who we used to go see at his funeral, at his grave once a year. I think his birthday was in July, and we used to drive over there. He described us in the context that we were maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality, outright mental defectives, you know, producers of confusion and children of chaos. And that was our strong point, you know, like And the bottom line is that within the context of that, we had to find somebody that we could live with. And in order to do that, you have to jettison a lot of the other stuff. And the guys who wrote this book are so streetwise. I mean, they're spiritual, but they are so streetwise. You know, they say like in the third step, you know, about turning your will and your life over. But before you get to that, they tell you what? lack of power. That's our dilemma. We have no power. And most people buy that. Most people buy that. And then when they get to the third step, they become very obstinate to give up something they don't have. You know? When you turn your will and your life over, you haven't lost anything because you didn't have it in the first place. You know? And that's how these guys operate, you know? And then after you take the step, it says, the next line is, we thought well before taking this step. Well, why the hell didn't you tell us that a few sentences back, you know? Like, why did you wait to this point to get into this, you know? And that's the kind of guys they are. And then you have people wandering around who say things like, well, if I continue to turn my will and my life over, I'll become like the hole in the donut. Watch my lips. We are the hole in the donut. We are. And thank God we are, because the donut comes and goes, but the hole is always there. You know? That's the deal. You know? So be thankful. Yeah, who are you? I'm a hole. You know? And I'm consistent, you know? And the deal is, if lack of power is our dilemma, then conversely, lack of dilemma is our power. You got to move fast here. We're sitting on a pendulum on a clock that's wound for eternity, so let's get with it, you know? This is the deal. And the deal is that, you know, that's why we go through this stuff. And thank God Silky tells us a little bit about ourselves, because throughout the book, there are things, if he didn't tell you up front how delusional you were, you know? If alcoholics don't like the image in the mirror, they think the appropriate action is to break the mirror, you know? You know, we scratch shit that don't itch. You know, we're always in pursuit of something that hasn't gone anywhere. You know, I'm after it now. You know, looking for it. Yeah. And the deal is that what you find out here is that, you know, there's no place to go, there's nothing to do, and we have forever to get it done. You know, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're trying to escape from a reality you're not in. You know? We do drive-bys to reality. What was that? Oh, just reality. You know? Next time, let's take a picture, you know? That's just the way it is. And the reason I love to come and do these things is I love to hear people laugh. I just love to hear people laugh. Because I know a couple of things about laughter that most people don't know. And that is, you cannot laugh and think at the same time. So every time you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you, you know? And God knows you need to break, you know? And the reality here is that as you go along, you get to see that in each of these steps, there's something built in there that looks like it's what we should be doing, but in fact, that's just a cover-up, you know? I'm amazed at people today who still tell me, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Did you ever have somebody tell you, I don't know what to do? Well, let's look at this step here. It says, when we retire at night. Now, what do you think that would be? You're like, maybe when you got your little jammies on and you're going to bed, you know? We constructively review the day. Not destructively, we constructively review the day, you know? And then we see what's going on. And then the next part is even trickier. Upon awakening. So like when you open your eyes for the first time and you go, oh man, this is upon awakening. I'm upon awakening right now. And then during the day it says, we pause when agitated. Not we pause if agitated. We know you're going to be agitated, you know? Because there ain't a whole lot you like, you know? So, you pause, and you I pause. Ah, what a refreshing thing. I think I'll pause again, you know? Hey, I'm really getting into this pausing, you know? And the reality is that, you know, you just have to kind of get out of your mind. When I first got here, I thought myself and most alcoholics, we used our minds too much. I've changed in that area. I think our minds use us, and we don't use them at all. You know? I mean, you wouldn't take this crap from your hand. You know? If your hand said, I'm going out to get a soda, hey, not without me, you know? But our minds, we just let take over, and people have committees. I don't know what the heck they're talking about. Well, I got committees, and, you know, and when I wake up in the morning, I say, good morning. I say, who said so? You know, I don't know what that's all about. I mean, I can see that when you're in the early stages of this thing, but when you're here a while, you're supposed to be letting go of this stuff. And this stuff is supposed to be going away, and it gets an easier deal. You know, and it doesn't mean it goes away all the way. It just goes away far enough that you don't get arrested for it. You know, I was flying out of the Farmington Airport and the Durango Airport for a while doing this stuff. And, you know, the Farmington Airport, they call it the Four Corners. And that's about how big it is. It's maybe the size of this. It's, or a little bit, runways like that, you know. And the guy who checks you in and asks for your ID is the same guy who takes you through the machine. And the same guy asks for your ID again. It's like, didn't we just meet, you know? Do I look like somebody different who you just met 2 minutes ago? But that's not the end of it. He checks your ID again when you get on the plane. Now, I'm not talking about cargo buses here. I'm talking 12 people in an airplane. You know, which maybe 8 seats are taken. You know? Oh yeah, let's see your ID. Home security, I think, is getting a little far out there. And I like to travel light, and I always put my hair dryer with my underwear. Now that sounds very confusing, unless you've been around a while and travel. I have a very inexpensive, cheap, almost unmentionable kind of hair dryer. So I wrap it in my underwear. And now my hair dryer has become very suspect. And when the guy takes it out, my underwear goes on the ground. It's my underwear, so I reach for it. Oh! Under FAA rules, you can't touch anything until I'm done looking. Oh, okay. So this happens 3-4 weeks in a row. You'd think he'd be catching on. It's me, it's my underwear, and it's my hairdryer, you know? And he takes it each time like it's, you know, new stuff. And he puts it under a screening device. So I went home, and, you know, I don't like to get arrested anymore. I don't like to go to jail, and I never do that stuff. And so God and I are really close. I mean, you know, he loves you guys, but he's ecstatic about me. And I got down and I prayed about what I could do for this. So it came to me very clearly what I had to do. I realized that they can take stuff from you, and I also realized you can leave stuff with them. So I went to Target and got the biggest pair of women's pink panties I could find. And guess what I wrapped my hair dryer in? And when I got to the airport, Slick, my number one man, puts my stuff through, opens my suitcase in front of everybody, and pulls out the hair dryer. And these pink panties just... And I said, don't pick them up. I got another pair. And you'd be surprised. I had to give up my shoes, my socks. I mean, suddenly I became Bin Laden. I mean, but you know what? I have to do those things to maintain sanity. I have to be who I am, because if I'm not who I am, I ain't who I am. You know, and I know that God understands all this stuff because he and I communicate on a regular basis. Life gets real easy when you're in tune with everything else that's going on. You know, I love to laugh, but in my lifetime, like most people in here, I've experienced some things that just were not really funny. Were not really funny. In 1993, I had a son who got very, very sick. And he came home to me in July, and he was in full-blown AIDS, and 2 months later, he was dead. And I got to see him go from about 185 pounds down to about 110 pounds. And I couldn't understand what was happening. This disease was just ravaging him. And I had no control over it whatsoever. And so it came to me that there's a grief that goes so deep that you cannot talk about it to very many people. Because unless they've had similar experiences of loss, it's just an intellectual thing for them. And that's the way life is. It's not good or bad, it's just the way it is. But I learned a lot about pain at that time. And in our book it says, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And I got through school totally unscarred by education. So I had to go look and see what a touchstone was. And a touchstone is a device that the old miners used. It was like a flintstone. And you rub things against it, silver and gold, and it tells you, based on the mark it makes, what the quality of the mineral is. I didn't know that for a long time. And so pain is like that. But I'm going to tell you something. This is my experience, is that pain in and of itself isn't worth a hoot. Does absolutely nothing for you. What gives me the spiritual growth is surrender. When I have to accept that which is totally unacceptable and give it up, then I get the spiritual growth. And my experience in that area is that it's a quantum leap. You go from ego to egolessness. You go from mind to no mind. You go from dark to light. It's all done in a single step. And you can't really talk about it to a whole lot of folks because that's not their understanding. And that's okay. But I got a chance to go through that. And in going through that, what happened was I had a door open. You know, in our literature, we talk a lot about the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality. And we get glimpses of this. And we have various ways of describing it. People will say, I have a moment of clarity. Bill talked about a moment of clarity in front of the Winchester Cathedral. We talk about epiphanies, and we talk about all of these things. They're all momentary. But in that momentary glance, we get to see the really real. And once you've seen the really real, then you have what I call an experience. And once you have an experience, you can never be the same way again. You just can't. You know, Bill Wilson talked a lot about fire. He was a real spiritual kind of guy in his own way, and he talked a lot about fire. In fact, he even described Eddie as being on fire. In front of me was a man on fire when he came to see me. And he talks about in Pass It On how he wanted to be close to the fire. He wanted to be warm. And that's really what the sixth step worked out for me. You know, in the sixth step, you can live very comfortably here, and you can be happy, joyous, and free, but you're not necessarily doing God's will. You're doing a will that works, but it's not God's will. And that's why this fire, this spiritual fire, is very interesting to me, because there's two kinds of people. Those who walk into the fire and are totally consumed by it, and are totally changed by it, and they can never go back to being what they were. And then there's a group, and I belong to this group for a long time, I think, where we want to be close to the fire to be warm, but we don't want to be burnt. We want to be close to it, just close to it, but don't want to get burnt. And that's living half a life. That's living half a life. Being consumed by the fire is what it's about. Now, if you're not ready to be consumed tonight, I understand that. Don't, you know. Yeah, and so does your sponsor. But don't worry about it, because sooner or later, God is in such hot pursuit of all of us, nobody gets away. And sooner or later, he'll just snag you, you know. You'll be like one of those little trout on the San Juan. You'll be going along thinking, oh, the lures are over there, and the big fishermen are over here. And I'm just going along, out in the middle, totally safe. And you don't know there's an eagle coming down on you. And all of a sudden, you're lunch. and you say, ain't really very funny. And as I said, you don't want to make mistakes here early on. You know, I go back to New York today and I hear about some of my early exploits in sobriety. But they've been added to now. I had a guy, I mean, we were eating lunch, and it was a nice Italian lunch. I don't know why. And we were having the nice baked ziti and stuff, and everybody seemed to be relaxed. And the guy says, you know, I was in a bar the other night, and there was a guy drunk out of his mind. Totally drunk out of his mind. And I thought, wow, I'm going to go over and let him know I'm an alcoholic and see if I can help. So he went over to this guy, he says, and he said to him, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and perhaps you could use our help. And he said, this guy whirled around on me, and he had a huge garbage can lid mark from here to here. And he looked at me and said, I called once, didn't work for me. You know, it didn't work for me. So be careful what you do early on, because the story gets added to, you know. I didn't tie him to the car, you know. I didn't run him down, you know. I didn't take his wife too, you know. It's not none of that stuff. But the deal is that when you're here early on, if you're going to make a big mistake, try not to let too many people know about it, you know. And the deal is here, after a while, what you find out, and I wouldn't suggest this to newcomers, but I don't think we have too many here tonight. And that's the deal, is that after you take your fifth step, I know New York won't go for this, but my suggestion would be is we print it in your local newspaper. Everything would be out on the table, and they'd move on to somebody else. And you would never have to worry about being found out about anything, because it would all be public knowledge. And the nice part about that is you'd be happy, joyous, and really free, you know, really free. And the deal is that's the deal here for me. I took these steps, and in taking these steps, I was evicted from my hiding places. And I got to see me for the first time. You know, and I like the words of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wouldn't change any of them. But, you know, about 10, 15 years ago, a word drifted into our program. It's not a bad word. It's not something that causes me sleepless nights. It's just not a good AA word. And that word is denial. Denial. You know, you look up the word denial in the dictionary, and it's really kind of wispy. It says, somebody who knows the truth, who just doesn't want to tell it. Denial. That's not what our literature says, at least not what I read. It says we're delusional. You look up the word delusional, it says psychotic thought. Where the individual involved has no concept of reality. You know, that's our word, you know. I mean, guys tell me they're in denial, that's like spiritual progress, you know, like, keep going. Rigorous honesty is right around the corner. You know? You're on the path now, Tiger, you know. And the deal is that we got to remember delusional, because it is delusional. You know, you watch newcomers come in, and it's like the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning. And you know, they have that look. And they have a thinking pattern that everybody knows is based on insanity. You know, it's sometimes you just feel like saying, you know, I don't want to cause you any discomfort because you're a newcomer, but you're an outright mental defector. You know? You're in full flight from reality. You know, you're delusional. You're a child of chaos, and you're a producer of confusion in your best moments. You know? And I think we ought to just tell them up front, or maybe just have little cards we can hang on their necks, you know? And I was one of those guys, too, because, as I said, I went into this meeting, and they gave me this little red tag, and everybody just kind of knew I was a newcomer. And I was there like 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and I got a 90-day little token. And when I went up to get the token, I looked around the room, and I thought, how do these folks always know I'm a newcomer? And then it hit me. They all had blue name tags. I had a red name tag. You just can't sneak too much past me, you know? So after the meeting, I went over and I said to the guy, hey! I was a good hey guy. Hey! How come I got a red name tag? And she said, oh, Ken, you're ready for blue. And she took it off and put the other one on. And I thought, you got to keep a sharp eye on some of these folks, you know? And the deal is that in the process of doing all of this,
I got a chance to do life on the natural. When my son was dying, he got so weak that he couldn't walk anymore. And he wanted to maintain his dignity. So he would crawl to the bathroom. And I put comforters and pillows on the floor so that he could do that. And it would take sometimes an hour for him to go a very short distance. And one day, as I was watching him, it hit me very clearly that my son was crawling on the floor to maintain his dignity. And I had crawled on the floor and lost my dignity. So crawling on the floor is neither good nor bad. It's why are you there? And you know, in life, that has held me in good stead, because I know today a number of things that I couldn't have told you with any clarity several months ago, or maybe just a few years ago. I know what the spiritual malady is for me today. That spiritual malady is, if I'm trying to live where God isn't, that's my spiritual malady. Today's July 6th. This is the best July 6th I ever had. I've never done July 6th, 2002. So far, I've been raising hell with it, you know? I'm going to kick the daylights out of it. When I get into bed tonight after saying my prayers, I'm going to say, well, that 6 took a hell of a shot, you know? And if I wake up in the morning, hey, that's when I do the 7th, you know? I don't want to be trying to do the 7th on the 6th. And I don't want to be reflecting that much on the 5th on the 6th, because I can't do anything about it. You know, and what came to me with clarity that I never had before is that God is always in this moment. And if I'm in this moment, I'm with God. And if I'm anywhere else, that's where I have a spiritual malady. That's why I feel detached. That's why I feel all this nonsense that I feel. It's not by accident that we wrote in our book, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May we find him Thursday. You know? You know, the deal is he's in this moment. He's in this moment. He's right here. And if I'm in this moment, I have a shot at him, because that's where he's hanging out. And I can't do anything about those things I can't do anything about. That was another big revelation for me. You know, one day I woke up and I said, what can I do about this? And I said, nothing. And then I got into a little bit of that call of the newcomer, you know. Yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. But the deal is that I now know today I can't do anything about things I can't do anything about. As I said, you don't slip too much past me. The other thing I know is that the more I surrender, the more I win. If I can surrender to everything that causes me pain, and I know what pain is now, it's a resistance to what is. That's all it is. I'm resisting the way it is. I want it some other way. And so if I just surrender to it, it doesn't mean I have to live with it forever. It just means I have an inner phenomena, which is peace, and I can do whatever actions I can do. But if I can't do anything, why do it? We used to have guys back east who were just brilliant guys, totally unscarred by education, you know? And they would say things like, you know, Kent, the wall is so high you can't get over it. And so old you can't get under it. And so wide you can't get around it. Maybe you belong on this side. You can't get sober without those guys. You know? There was a guy in our group, Lewis, and Lewis used to read his digest, and he would do the word vocabulary thing, and he would always jump, hold one finger where the word was, and then jump to the back, where the answer was. And one day a newcomer said to him, you know, a newcomer, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, he said to him, Lewis, you're supposed to look at the word, and then there are 4 options, and you guess which one is right. And Lewis looked at this guy like he had grown a head. And he said, why would I guess if I know where the answer is? You know? And that's the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a big book. You know, it's an owner's manual. And when something comes up, you look in it, and it tells you what you do. And yet you have people running around, getting totally confused, reading all kinds of nonsense, and coming back and looking at you like, I'm in a lot of pain. Yeah, because you're trying to do something about something you can't do anything about. You know? That's the reason you're in pain. The guys who wrote this book had spiritual insight coming out of their ears. They said powerful things, unbelievable, insightful things like, when the alcoholic drinks, something happens. I mean, come on now. You go to the library today, there's volumes on alcoholism, and you have something happens. What is it? Something. Can you be more specific? It happens. And the deal is that life kind of just goes that way. When I made this move 6 months ago, there were a lot of people who thought I was losing my mind, and they'd call me to tell me that. And I thanked them for the compliment. And I told them, I haven't lost it yet, but I'm working on it. And the deal is that I know a peace today that I never had in my entire life before. I'm not at war with anyone or anything. I have nobody that I'm upset with. I have nothing to figure out. I keep telling people I don't know to the point where some of them are now believing me. You know? I think if you tell enough people you don't know, it cuts down on a lot of questions. You know? You know? I notice that people who are busy answering questions are people who know. Or at least say they know. You know? I don't want to know what they know. I want to not know what I don't not know. You know? I don't want to wake up in the morning and figure it out. I want to get up in the morning and live it out. You know? I don't want to be on this fear thing all the time. When I first got here and I was driven by 100 forms of fear, I thought, well, you know, alcoholics tend to be excessive, you know? But now that I've been here a while, it could be way more than 100 forms of fear. Way more. And the fear that captivates and seems to hold most of us the longest is this phantom fear. It's not real. It's about what might happen. It's not about what is happening.
Yeah, but this might happen.
Yeah, and monkeys may fly out of my butt, but I wouldn't count on it tonight, you know? This is July 6th. It hasn't happened, you know? People worrying about when their kids go to college and the kid's 4 months old, you know? And you gotta kind of watch people because they really get psychotic. And they really think that what they're thinking is real. And the bottom line is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells us that there is a great reality. And that reality is deep down inside each one of us, the fundamental idea of God. You know, I see people running around and they're getting baptized and analyzed, you know, and they're ranting and chanting and having everything read from cards to palms to chakras to, they're going to Tibet, India, Thailand. Somehow they think God is inconsistent with indoor plumbing. You know, like, you know, I can't find God unless I get hepatitis, you know. Our little book in the chapter, We Agnostics, says deep down inside every one of us, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And it's only there that it can be found. And we're looking all over the place. And the deal is it came with us. You know, my son works in a research center up in Seattle, the Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And he keeps me up on what's going on with DNA. And the DNA stuff that we hear about is stuff that catches criminals and stuff. And I guess that's good too. You know, it serves a purpose. But almost 99% of our DNA is exactly alike. That tells me we all got sent out from the same home office. You know? There's really no difference. The difference we live with, we've made up. You know, it's a perceptional thing. You know? It's like a snail sitting on a turtle going, whee! You know, can make a big deal out of this stuff, you know? We're running around giving useless information to people in some cases because it doesn't come out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're in this room tonight and anybody tells you anything about alcoholism, if they can't substantiate it with the 12 and 12 in the big book, then they're speculating. And don't let anybody speculate with your life. It's too important. Too important. You know? And don't be so worried about a career. People are like, oh, that's my career. Well, you'll find out. In New York, when you got sober, nobody ever talked about career. They go, hey, yo, get a job. You know? Get off the corner. Make your mother proud, you know? Try to do something that's not indictable, you know? Don't complicate life so much, you know? I can't tell you tonight everything I've learned in 32 years, but I can tell you some of the things, and that is that there's one who has all power, and that one is God. That the more I surrender, the more I win. And the other thing is, the more vulnerable I become to life, the more invulnerable I am. You know, this is not about waiting around. This is about getting out and doing it. You know, go do something. You have people that are worried about making mistakes. We're counting on you making mistakes. I mean, the air we breathe is no good. The forest fires are sucking up the oxygen. Firemen are setting fires. I mean, it's like, just look at the news sometime. You know, like, the food has carcinogens in them. You know, any day out of the Hudson River is going to come a 400-pound mackerel with two eyes on the back of his head saying, I want to see somebody from Dow Chemical right now. You know, like, And the deal is that, pension plan, we've lost $2 trillion in this country in the last year. $2 trillion has just disappeared. I mean, we had a good neighborhood, but nothing like that, you know? You know, absolutely nothing like that. You know, these guys are teaching us, you know? And the deal is what about the future? This is the future. You may not have a future. You may die tonight. Everything you're worried about would be, poop, you know? I got so much into this, and now I don't get anything out of it, you know? And this is terrible, you know? And in our 11th step, it tells you the whole thing is about, we need this energy. We can't be wasting this energy because this energy is our spiritual energy. And if you use it thinking, God bless you, it's like watching a battery just wear down. You know, in the 11th step, it tells us what? We don't do that stuff anymore. And what happens is we have more energy. We're disciplined. We don't tire so easy. Why? Because we're not spending endless days worrying about phantom fears about some future that we're probably not ever going to see. You know, it's like milking a mouse. It's a lot of activity, but very little results, you know? So the deal is tonight is, as you go forth from this place, and hopefully you escape some of you know? There's a dance after this, if you can imagine that, and more to come, you know? I mean, they're going to have a blues band, you know? They'll be playing all those great songs that you remember, you know. I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you, you know. Throw a saddle on the stove, mama, we're riding a range tonight, you know. I used to kiss her on the lips, but it's all over now, you know. I'm a sucker for the old romantic tunes, I'll tell you. But this is the deal, and laugh, because we're laughing at you. You know, like, so be in on the joke. It's supposed to be happy, joyous, and what does God want? Happy, joyous, and free. Yes, but what does it really mean? You know? We're not a glum lot. I know, but what else? We manufacture our own misery. Stop loading me up with information. I need some emotional input, you know? And that's who we are. And if you're not laughing, you're missing it. You're missing it. This is a great ride. And someday you're going to get your ticket punched. And when that ticket is punched, you want to have had the ride. You don't want to be thinking about the ride. planning for the ride, standing in line to get a ticket to a non-ticketed event, you know? You want to be out there screwing stuff up, you know? You know, you want to go forth and multiply, you know? That usually comes very easy here, you know? And look around at the people who are in the room with you. You know, you're like, oh. You say, these are the people I'm going to count on. These are the folks who are going to carry me to the end zone. You know, I'm good. You know, I can get it between the 20-yard lines, but when it gets to the tough yards, I need someone to help me take it in. And that's what God is. You know, God isn't a substitute. He's the deal. You know, I went to a guy I ran bookie for, and then I'll shut up. And I was running numbers for this guy, and his name just happened to be Vinny. But there's no mafia. And I said, Vinny, do you believe in God? That's how I talked to him. Vinny, do you believe in God? Do you think there's a God? And he said, Ken, will you run numbers for me for how long? I said, 4 or 5 years. He said, do we ever lose? I said, no, we don't. Sometimes somebody will. I'm not talking about somebody. Do we ever lose? And the answer I gave him was no. And he said, do you think God is going to make a game he loses? Vinny was a spiritual giant. And the deal is that God is in such hot pursuit. He doesn't let any of us get away. You know, we only have two jobs here on this earth. And one is to be of service to one another. And if for some reason we're not in a position or a mindset or an emotional tempo right now to do that, then our job is not to hurt one another. If you can help, you help. If you can't, don't hurt. You know, we got to take really good care of one another because we're only on loan. This is a blink. You know, I've lost brothers and sisters to this thing. I had a brother and a sister die a week apart. One died Christmas Day, one died New Year's Day. And I remember going to the cemetery and their little deals weren't even up, but I got to look at the headstones. And on the headstones it has your name, the date you were born, and a dash that runs maybe 6 or 8 inches on the headstone. And that dash is life. That's what it's about. I don't know where you guys are along, but I'm a long way into the dash. I don't have time to be angry. I don't have time to be resentful. I don't want to waste 1 second of this precious thing called life. And the way I keep doing that is by, if something is bothering me, I surrender to it. It's an amazing thing to surrender because it immediately takes the pressure off. People say, how do you know when you surrender? There's no more resistance. The mind is synonymous with resistance, and God is no mind. So as soon as you surrender, you have no thoughts about it. You just move on. And life gets real peaceful. There's a guy who used to come to my house, who I love very, very much, who couldn't stay sober and ended up taking his own life. And he used to come into my house and go namaste, Ken. And he was a Hindu. And namaste, loosely translated, means the God in me sees the God in you. And as long as the God in me sees the God in you, we won't hurt one another. We can disagree. We can even be judgmental at times. They knew that. That's why they wrote the 10-step the way they did. You know, love and tolerance. You don't have tolerance unless you're judging something. You know, when you get to love, you don't judge. Love isn't judging. You know? And love is the answer. No matter what the question, love is the answer. And love is always right. Reason fails, but love never fails. And if you're wandering around here looking for the right person, you know, remember, don't try to find a custom fit in an off-the-rack world, you know? You know, realize that the people you see are going to have some notches, you know? And try not to milk a mouse about this thing. And please, please, whatever you do, take real good care of one another. I want to thank you for letting me come, and I'm going to close with a little thing that I just love because it's something that's important to me. And it goes like this. You cannot catch hold of it, nor can you let go of it. In not being able to get it, you'll get it. When you are speaking, it's silent. When you are silent, it speaks. God bless you.